Calder Walton is a world-leading expert on intelligence, national security, and geopolitics. He's written two books, the latest of which is Spies, the epic intelligence war between East and West. It is a best-selling expose of the history of Russian intelligence that challenges the idea that the Cold War ended with the Soviet Union's collapse in 1991, but in fact continued after down to the present day. He argues the West is now in a new Cold War, with Russia as well as China. Welcome to Silicon Curtain. Please like and subscribe to help people find the fantastic guest speakers that we feature on the channel. Please also buy me a coffee if you like the materials we create. But before you do that, check out the validated Ukrainian charities that appear in the description of the video. It's never been more important than it is now to help Ukraine resist Russian aggression. Calder, welcome to Silicon Curtain.
Thank you for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
It's a huge pleasure for me too. And this is an absolutely fascinating topic, which, whereas I think there's a lot written about the classic days of Cold War espionage, unfortunately, it seems that we are in a new era of the same. What's been the sort of resurgence of interest in this topic, really? In the last couple of years, when, the media, maybe not covering it in the detail it should, but certainly covering renewed stories of Russian spies, sabotage and espionage in the West.
Well, you're absolutely right that we do seem to be in a new era, a geopolitical clash that has lots of similarities and in some cases a continuum from Cold War, what we could call Cold War 1.0 in the last century, to Cold War 2.0. The essence of the first Cold War was, of course, nuclear weapons, and that remains the case today. And that means, really, that was from 1945 onwards, and then when the Soviets detonated their first atomic weapon, that was a game changer in the history of warfare, meaning that one side that had a nuclear weapon and the other side that had a nuclear weapon, there was quickly the development of mutually assured destruction. And that is such a fundamental game changer compared to earlier periods in history that, to my mind, there is a sharp break in the history of warfare when that happens. That's what George Orwell quite rightly described in terms of what the essence of the Cold War would involve in his essay in 1945, where he coined the phrase Cold War. And that still seems to be the case today. So far, as we all know, Cold War has not spilled over into hot war, although Putin's nuclear saber rattling certainly seems to be terrifying people I speak to in the US government and on the UK side. Now, what's been the resurgence of intelligence? I would say that there is again, continuums, similarities, but also differences between the nature of intelligence and national security now compared to Cold War 1.0. You're absolutely right. The media attention focus in the recent years picked up on some of the extraordinary spy scandals and cases that we were living through, but with the best will in the world, perhaps did not situate them and contextualize them in a way that they deserved. And that's really where what I tried to do in my book. I'm speaking to you from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and over here in the US, lived through the Trump years, the Trump saga, and all of the questions that still exist about Trump's relationship with Putin. This was a really extraordinary time to be living in the United States, and I fear that what will happen in the upcoming election in November in this country, I fear we're going to see a Trump 2.0, but we'll perhaps leave that for now. So that was the most visible manifestation of Russian intelligence and espionage doing things that they have traditionally done, but adapted for the new media digital environment. I'm talking about election interference. I showed in the book that actually Soviet election interference, meddling in US presidential elections, started as early as 1948. What Russia was doing in 2016 was very much a continuum of what the Kremlin had done in the past, but they were using new digital means the new digital ecosystem in order to carry out those older strategies. So that was really living through it and witnessing it. And then, of course, the book became even more urgent to finish writing it as the war in Ukraine broke out. And to go back to your introduction, it seems to me that the war in Ukraine and Ukrainians' defense against Russian aggression is a battlefield in a much broader geopolitical global collision that we are on between the West and our forms of democracy and authoritarian states represented by Russia and China. So that's where I came from, Jonathan. That was the sort of motivation. That was a long answer to your question.
Not at all. It was a fantastic introduction. And before we hit record, we were talking a little bit about my experience in the 90s, and of course, you've spent extensive time in the archives. Now, Putin has declared, and this is often quoted, so I'm going to try and put a different angle onto it. He's declared that the USSR was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. That appears to be and it's often ascribed to him personally and his own perspective. No one I met in the 90s or spoke to expressed a view that the USSR should be recreated or the territories that form part of it should be reacquired. This seems to be very much something that has been channeled through propaganda and amplified in the last decade or so. But how far is this view of Putin's that the Soviet Union disappearing was a catastrophe? How far is this his personal view? Or how far is it the view of a kind of paranoid FSB caste or KGB caste that he was brought up into?
Well, it's a great, great question, Jonathan. So I think what Putin's talking about when he says that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century isn't so much about creating the Soviet Union again, which, I mean, there may be echoes of that, but rather I think what he's really getting at is a hard right Russian nationalist and Russia's humiliation on the global stage. I think that that's what he's talking about, that it's not so much looking to recreate a communist empire in any way, shape or form, but it's really about Russia's humiliation. Now, I know you lived in Russia in the 1990s, interviewing a few people, particularly one person who was working at the US consulate in Leningrad in the early 1990s, who interacted with Putin then in those early days when he was working in the regional government in Leningrad. My sources' stories about Putin at those early days was that his hatred of the United States was palpable even then in 92, 93, 94, that he was convinced that the United States engineered the collapse of the Soviet Union. And that this was a humiliation for Russia on the world stage, which in many ways it was, let's be honest. Situating Russian end of empire, its collapse of empire within a broader context of other European powers. I mean, we all know the dislocation that can cause imperial powers. Query whether the UK has ever really come to terms with its past in terms of the end of its empire. That, of course, was similar in Russia, but the difference with Russia is that it experienced the collapse of its empire in the body of the Soviet Union in two short years. So I think it's fair to say, and here I'm picking up in my research on the work by journalists like Catherine Belton in her book on Putin and his connections with the KGB and the early Russian security state. I think it's fair to say that Putin and the people around him in the regional governments and then percolating all the way through to the Kremlin experienced something of a phantom limb syndrome, that the the essence of the great in the great power had been cut off, and that they were no longer a great power on the world stage. So I think that that's what he's getting at. And then you scratch the surface even further. And as you said, it doesn't take long for you to discover that this, let's call it what it is, deep state, Russian security state conspiracy theory that blamed everything that was happening to Russia in the early 1990s, its economic collapse, not on any kind of dysfunction that existed in the Soviet period, or indeed systemic corruption in the Russian government itself, but on the hidden hand of the West and the United States in particular. And it's literally out of that pretty toxic mix that Putin emerges to become FSB director in 1998, and then Yeltsin's successor in 1999.
And what I find fascinating about your book is the line that jumped out to me, that this is not a new phenomenon. The paranoia, this conspiratorial thinking, the projection of aggression, whether it's cold or hot aggression, is nothing new. You describe this as a 100-year war, which can be traced back to the 19th century. When did we start to see something that is identifiably like the sort of KGB or Cheka or whatever incarnation? When did that first start to emerge? Because it's often traced to 1917, but actually the roots of the police state and some of its techniques are a lot older.
No, you're absolutely right, Jonathan. So, you know, I could have started the book even earlier. The Great Game, the rivalry between the British and Russia, in in India, in Afghanistan. This is the period of Kim, you know, the great game that never ceases day and night. So certainly could have started the book even earlier than I did, but I do see 1917 as a watershed moment when the Bolsheviks seize power, but then crucially, absolutely crucially, then when Western powers decided to intervene in the ensuing Russian Civil War. And I see that point really, what happens is the establishment of two essentially incompatible worldviews between Western liberal democracy, capitalist, and Bolshevik communism. And those two forms of government, it seems to me, were on a collision course. That collision course only really ostensibly became ostensibly visible to the rest of the world in the war in the years after 1945. But I think you can't understand what was going on if you don't understand that earlier period. But you're absolutely right. I mean, on one level, we could have started. I think my editors of my book would have. Well, I think I can guess their reaction if I said, actually, we need to start the chapter, have a first chapter on the Tsarist Okhrana, the secret police in Britain, and at the Great Game. We were already at breaking point with this book in terms of the size. So that was just a bridge too far. But you're absolutely right. If you really
prequel.
Want
to, topic for a
yeah,
prequel.
There man. We go. Exactly. New introduction.
I'm going to stick on this topic just for a little bit longer, because I think it's important to put it in context. Fundamentally, we're talking a lot about here about, you know, external spy agencies, those operating in Western companies, Western countries, perceived enemies, and so on. But if we take the origins of the secret state back to, say, the 1870s and the vast acceleration of urbanization, industrialization, did the spy networks originally come out of the requirement, not necessarily so much for external spying, but actually to keep an eye on their own people and to keep an eye on these forces that are being unleashed by these processes of urbanization and, you know, increased education as well?
So I think it depends on which countries you're talking about. I think in
Russia
in the,
specifically here.
In the Russian case. Empire, in the Russian case. Yeah. In the Russian case, that's certainly the case. Yeah, there's that's what the classic histories of the Okhrana reveal. And indeed, that is what the early Soviet Bolshevik Cheka, what it continued. It was domestic. It was regime perseverance, preservation, to keep the party in power. That was what the sword and the shield, the early slogan for the Cheka, was all about. And external proactive external intelligence collection was an offshoot of that domestic regime security, if you like. So I see that. I think you're absolutely right that there's a striking parallel there between from the sort of the 1870s onwards with what the Bolsheviks then, who, by the way, had been on the receiving end of a lot of the tradecraft of the Russian secret state, so knew its tradecraft inside out, that they then redeployed for their own use. All of this, Jonathan, lies in stark contrast to what was going on in the UK at that moment. So British intelligence, you know, at the turn of the century, famed for its secret service that apparently had tentacles across the world, absolute load of nonsense. So Britain's intelligence services weren't actually established until 1909, which is extraordinarily late in the day, at least compared to Russia. And when they were established, they were essentially man and dog operations. So this is a situation where the fiction far surpassed the facts in terms of the reality on the ground of actually what the British secret state, the capabilities it had on the outbreak of the First World War, and then in the messy aftermath of it.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? And we kind of forget the extent to which the Allied powers did try to intervene in the Russian Revolution. Then came a period of instability, which really is I guess is the birthplace, as you say, of sort of Russian espionage. But it's also combined with propaganda. So what's the mix here? And what's the main focus of Russian external spy operations when they first come out? And how's that changed over the years? Is it to, you know, gather information on your enemy or adversary? Is it to convince your adversary that you are stronger than you actually are to prevent attacks on the nascent Bolshevik state? Or is it to steal ideas, industrial secrets, etc.? Or have these had, you know, different focus at different periods in the history of Russian espionage?
Well, Jonathan, I think you've answered your own question, and it's not one thing or the other. It's actually all of what you've just laid out. So you're absolutely right that early Soviet in the 1920s and 30s foreign intelligence collection involved what we could call political intelligence collection. So, and this is the stuff that, let's be fair, all states do, or all states conduct, to understand the aims and intentions and capabilities of your foreign adversaries. And the Soviets were extraordinarily good at doing so. They relied on ideologically committed communist true believers, recruited in particular at some of the leading universities on both sides of the Atlantic. Yes, the five Cambridge spies I'm thinking about recruited in the mid-1930s at or soon after leaving Cambridge. But there were also similar Soviet agents on this side of the Atlantic, on the US side, recruited from Ivy League colleges and others. That's traditional, let's say, political intelligence. The thing is that the Soviets were just much better at it than the Western counterparts at that point. And I think the game changer for them, what they had in their favor, as I said, is this ideological commitment on the part of communist true believers who saw Stalin squinting hazily at afar from the comfort of a Cambridge common room or from an Ivy League debate stand, saw that Stalin's Soviet Union was the best defense against the rise of fascism in Europe at the time. And there's a legitimate narrative there. You can see how that would be a seductive, but as I said, emphasis on the squinting from afar. because, of course, it was impossible to reconcile that with the barbarity of the Stalin's regime itself. But you're absolutely right. Then again, there was also a concerted effort to acquire as many scientific and technical secrets from Western powers as possible. And here again, we just see that the Soviet espionage tradecraft, was just much more sophisticated than anything that the Western counterparts, Britain particularly, but increasingly as those years went on, the United States could marshal. I mean, at the time in the run-up to the Second World War, the US government did not actually have a dedicated foreign intelligence service. So the CIA wasn't established until after the war in 1947. So the effort by Stalin and his spy chiefs to collect scientific and technical intelligence was all driven by what Stalin, from his reading of Marxism, viewed to be the quote-unquote inevitable clash or conflict with Western imperial powers, and that his ambition was to prepare the Soviet Union by stealing scientific and technical secrets for that inevitable conflict. Not necessarily a conflict in terms of war, but just a collision of class warfare. The most important of that was, of course, atomic research. I show in the book how Soviet intelligence, military intelligence, GRU, but also NKVD, OGPU, were targeting atomic research in Western countries much earlier, before the Second World War, before we had previously thought they had done so. And then the game changer is in 1943, when after Stalin discovers the secret of the US Anglo-American atom bomb project at Los Alamos, Stalin makes the decision in 1943 to build his own atomic research project. And he does so amid the Battle of Stalingrad, not with any idea that it would ever be used against the Third Reich, against the Nazi and Hitler, but would be used against Western powers, his allies. So that's a really, I think, speaks volumes to the direction and the collision that I spoke of earlier that manifested itself in the post-war years.
He perhaps understood Churchill a little better, because, of course, Churchill famously declared the idea that, once we polish off Nazi Germany, then that may run into continuation to move on Moscow.
That's exactly it. And then the thing is, the Churchill had been the sort of the leading voice, the chief crusader from the earlier period during the Russian Civil War of trying to unseat the Bolsheviks early on. So this is the thing about conspiracy theorists, be it Stalin in the past or Putin today. There's often a kernel of truth of what they're working from. Now, the problem is that then that sort of grows to grotesque proportions. But it really was the case that Churchill had a long track record of hating the Bolsheviks and trying to unseat them. And sure enough, the more that Stalin looked, the less he liked what he saw in terms of the Western powers. And there's an echo there, it seems to me, with Putin today.
That's very important, I think, because this is going to seem like quite an odd question, perhaps. But this idea that once an enemy, there's no capacity for change, there's no capacity for transformation. And that seems to transition through to Putin, and the fact that we're in a sort of, I think in one of my videos, I labeled it a cosplay version of World War II, which Russia seems to be kind of playing out. Are we at a systemic disadvantage in the way the Western mindset is clashing with, I'm going to say, broadly speaking, the Kremlin mindset? We have a concept of win-win, in that, you know, you can be challenged by an adversary, but then you can move on from that history, from that toxicity. And, you know, modern Japan and Germany are good examples, I'd say, of that win-win fundamental mindset at work there. Whereas it seems to me that the Kremlin mindset comes from something far more ancient, and that is a zero-sum game. There is no concept of win-win, therefore no concept of progress or transformation or change. I mean, do you accept that idea? And does that essentially put us at a disadvantage in the spy arena against Russia?
Well, so I wrote a piece soon after the book was published for Time magazine, in which I said, and the context was what would happen if Putin were deposed. This is after the Prigozhin mutiny or whatever you want to call it. And one of the main conclusions of my book is, I think, the point you're getting towards, which is, do we have a Putin problem right now? Yes. But we have something much bigger than a Putin problem. We actually have a Russia problem. And by Russia, I mean the government. And it is absolutely striking that when you see this in a 100-year tapestry, at key moments when we in the West thought that there were thaws, thought that there was a chance to reset, as Hillary Clinton famously, infamously tried to do, actually, that's a moment when, if you look at what the Soviet and now Russian intelligence services are doing, that's when they go on the offensive, when Western defenses are down. So that's why I come to the unfortunate conclusion that we have a Russia problem, and that even if Putin were removed, I think that there are people that he surrounds himself with. We've just seen a reshuffle this, I think, yesterday. He got rid of his defense minister. But these are still cut from the same cloth, the people that he surrounds himself with, the men of force, the Siloviki, if I've pronounced that right in Russian. So you're absolutely right that in the 1990s, for all the reasons that we all know about, we thought that Western democracy had triumphed. That there was the end of history, that it represented the end of history. But actually, if you read Francis Fukuyama's book, it's not, it's much more sophisticated than that, which is often suggested, because what he's really saying is the last man left standing, that could bring with it a whole bunch of problems on the international stage. And he was absolutely right in that. I would actually place much more emphasis on the last man rather than the end of history in his book than most commentators describe. And sure enough, that unipolar moment just absolutely fanned the flames in terms of what key decision makers in the Kremlin in the 1990s believed had been going on forever, which was US imperialism. And using international institutions as a way to constrain and contain Russian greatness. And it's out of that collision that Putin, as I said, emerges.
And are we in some ways in a more precarious position now? Because at the height of the Cold War, you essentially had a spy service, vast and aggressive as it was, but it played within certain rules. And in fact, nominally, it was representing a system, not an individual and their interests. It's representing, Bolshevik communism. It's also having to work in a system that has a party as well as a secret service. I'm harking here really to the ideas of Yuri Fedchinsky and a sort of nominal balance of powers within the Soviet Union. At this point in time, you have that vast apparatus of the Siloviki essentially operating at the behest of a, personal power, a personal autocracy. How precarious and dangerous is that situation?
I think that it's much more complicated and dangerous than it was in the Soviet period. As you said, during the Soviet times, the intelligence services worked as part of the apparatus for the party. The party's now disappeared. It works for one person. But here's the correction that I try to make in the book, and as we come to the closer time in those chapters of the book, which is Putin's, well, even during the Soviet period, the KGB's narrative that then got picked up by Russian intelligence in the 1990s is that Soviet and now Russian intelligence were and are professional services very similar to their Western counterparts. And what we see in Russia in the 1990s is this fusion between intelligence and security and Russian organized crime. I think it's fair to say that starts off with Putin in the early 1990s in Leningrad, gets incorporated into the FSB when he's director, and it only has continued and increased since he took power, which makes the FSB into something fundamentally different from anything that we find in the West. It's an instrument of state-backed organized crime, particular money laundering, for the personal profit of Putin and the oligarchs that he surrounds himself with. So you've got elements of the system, this is that continued on after 1991 into the reconstituted Russian intelligence services, the SVR and the FSB, but you also have this fusion of Russian organized crime, which makes it very different. Yes, there were, of course, elements of corruption, significant elements of corruption in the KGB's time, but this is in a brave new world in terms of the extent of corruption. In the court case between Berezovsky and Abramovich in the UK High Court, Jonathan Sumption, the counsel at the time, described, and I think it's absolutely right, described Putin's court as something analogous to a medieval court. And I think he's absolutely onto something there, that it isn't really, if you want to understand the if you want to understand how it works, it's not similar to the Kremlin in the Soviet period. It's got medieval properties to it, with rising factions in and out, people being killed. It's got its share of, let's be honest, court idiots and jesters and bad men. So I think that Jonathan Sumption was absolutely on the right track when he described it like that.
Ivan the Terrible is a prisoner, maybe more of a role model there.
But it's also on the element of on the narrative, the theme of organized crime. I think that again, in many ways, the Kremlin's narrative is that we want that it's similar to the Soviet Union, but in fact, I think if you really want to understand and counter Putin's court, Putin's Kremlin, perhaps the lesson to look to, the analogy to understand, is how we have taken down mafia leaders in the past. So look to Al Capone rather than to the Soviet period.
And how
And what
problematic.
I mean by that, sorry, John, what I mean by that in particular is follow the money. And I think that this was exemplified when with Navalny's expose about Putin's wealth. Like as with so many dictators, actually Putin is extraordinarily thin-skinned. And when he when Navalny showed the world allegedly, I should say, Putin's alleged mansion with all of his wealth, I think that really touched a nerve for Putin. So if we want to counter Putin, it seems to me that exposing his vast wealth and the lavish lifestyle while Russian citizens are being sent to the front line to fight in his war, I think that would be an extraordinarily valuable avenue to pursue for Western governments.
And I saw Mikhail Borisovich Khodorkovsky speak, I think it must have been about 8 years ago. And when asked how to deal with Putin's regime, he says something very similar to that, describing it as a sort of mafia grupirovka, as it were. And he was asked, well, what would you do then if you're a policymaker? And he simply said, break off all diplomatic relations, break off all economic ties, and blockade every aspect of the country. Now, of course, there were gasps of intake of breath for the shocked Guardian audience. That was far too sort of rich meat at that time, even though it was already after the invasion of Crimea. We're now 2 years into the war, and it seems that that idea still hasn't quite percolated. Yes, the worst aspects of Londongrad have kind of been shut down, but it does seem that we have not stopped the flow of components and trade via third parties into Russia. Massive sanctions, they haven't really worked. So how is, Russian espionage, which has really merged with big parts of its economy, mafia, oligarchs, etc. How has that then, that seems to have created an extraordinary amount of resilience actually in the Russian system.
It did. And I think that you have to give Putin his credit where credit's due, is he really solidified the preempted the Russian economy before the invasion to kind of buffer it. And you're absolutely right. Now you look at open source data on the flows of exports to third party countries, and they're just mushrooming. So it's quite clear, and you don't have to go very far online to see the latest Western gadgets, tech, freely available on in the stores in Russia. So Apple's, what is it? Their glasses they brought out 6 months ago, whatever it's called, Apple,
Oculus, is that
Ocul
one?
something like that, whatever it is. Anyway, within a matter of days, that was clear. That was quickly available in Russian stores, obviously by third party routes. But the big game changer for Russia is China, and the extent to which China keeps is continuing to both to sell Russian material and to buy Russian exports. And as long as that's continues to exist, seems to me that the Russian economy, despite everything that we're doing, will continue to be fine.
Well, let's turn to the harder edge of Russian espionage, because I think insurrection, sabotage are at the sort of slightly hotter ends of the scale when you compare it to a lot of the activity in the Cold War. We're now seeing signs of these emerging. I know someone like Keir Giles has comments, very frequently and in detail on these. It does not perhaps seem to be getting again the traction in the media and analysis that it deserves. How far do you think this will go? As Putin doesn't make obvious headway on the battlefield, is escalating in the so-called gray zone something which he is going to step up considerably?
I think that it will be logical for him to do so. I think that again, this is one of the classic out of, if you like, the KGB tradecraft manual. We're talking here about one of the many active measures, sabotage being a particular type of active measure, covert action, we would call it in Western countries. So is disinformation. In previous years, we saw a lot of disinformation. And I think we're now seeing traces, as you said, through particularly some of the court cases and the reporting in Europe and in UK in recent days and weeks about alleged Russian sabotage plans. There certainly seems to be, if you keep a tally of unexplained explosions and unfortunate activities for Western arms manufacturers and suppliers for Ukraine, there does seem to be a lot of that. But one can quickly then slide down into the realm of conspiracy and seeing a hidden hand where perhaps there isn't. For me, the bigger change, Jonathan, a thing that we're really all, at least in this country, waiting for is what will happen in November in the election here. Because Putin, for everything that's going on the battlefield of Ukraine, Putin will be hoping for a Trump victory. And if or when that does happen, and I'm afraid I'm pessimistic about this, without, I suppose I'll expose my own political inclinations, but I'm pessimistic about that. I think that Trump will win in November. And I think that he will then reach a deal with Putin and throw Zelensky under the bus. And he'll do that very quickly. So Putin, what he needs to do is hold on to November. and he can reach a deal. I think that what would be Putin's aim? What would be the best scenario? Well, obviously his public pronouncements has been that to eradicate Ukraine as a state. Whether he thinks that's realistic, even under a Trump deal administration, I don't know. But here's what I think that he would die a happy man if the following happened. If he reached a deal to retain Crimea, other parts of Ukraine, this is under a Trump deal. Trump says that he can reach a deal in 24 hours. But if Putin got those territories and then mounted an incursion somewhere in Europe within NATO that then showed the world that all said and done, NATO doesn't respond to an Article 5, Putin would die a happy man. If he could show that NATO is a figment by sending tanks into X, Y, and Z, into NATO territory, and we don't respond, he'll die a happy man.
And of course,
That's my
that could be prevented by sending troops to protect those sovereign areas of Ukraine that are not yet that are fully under Ukraine's control. But of course, that's not going to happen. You
exactly.
mentioned two very contentious areas earlier on, and there are certain people watching this who are not going to be particularly happy at this question, but Russia does seem to be adept at pouring petrol on the flames. It doesn't necessarily create the discontent that led to Brexit. It doesn't create the discontent and alienation of, say, sort of working class Americans that led to the rise of Trump. However, it will seek to leverage and exacerbate existing problems. There's been a lot of coverage, of course, in the US on the extent to which Russia interfered in the 2016 election or was even able to drive the vote towards the Trump camp. The equivalent kind of discussion seems to have been shut down in the UK, and there's been no serious research. And if the intelligence service has conducted anything, then that has certainly not been made sort of public, I suspect not. There's been no serious attempt to really understand whether Russian influence made a difference in that 2016 vote or not.
I point your listeners, the watchers, viewers, in the direction of the UK Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee's report, the Russia report, as it's called. And one of the most striking, one of the jarring aspects of the report was where they revealed that they asked, the committee asked MI5 for an assessment of Russian interference in the Brexit referendum. And the answer that came back was, I think, either five words or five sentences long. Either way, it was paltry. And that was a jarring anecdote, but it goes to the point that actually whose responsibility, who takes ownership for that in the UK? Yet in the US, for all of the problems in this country and in the government, there was the Mueller report that did go into detail about Russian interference in the 2016 election, but you're absolutely right. There has not been a Mueller report equivalent, and on the contrary, according to the that report I mentioned, it was such a hot potato that people apparently that no one agency or service wanted to take ownership for it. But the underlying issue is, as you quite rightly said, the working the strategy of Russian, of Soviet active measures and Russian active measures today. And indeed, it has to be said, to be fair, Western covert action, the corresponding strategy is that you can't, it will not, they will not be effective if we're talking about disinformation here or information warfare, simply creating a big lie out of nothing. You have to build on existing grievances within a target audience. And in the US here, there are plenty of grievances on which to build race relations and so on. And in the UK, Brexit was certainly one of those wedge issues. So did Russian intelligence seek to exploit those grievances with Brexit? Absolutely. Did it actually provide a margin in the referendum? As you say, who knows? This is I haven't seen any decent reporting on actually forensic reporting on that, and I think it would be extraordinarily valuable to do so.
And indeed, the digital effort, which is my area of expertise, which is digital marketing, a lot of that information is just too esoteric for, I think, to be accessible to most people. But I would welcome, some detailed research into how things like Cambridge Analytica may have at the very last minute sort of moved that. But I've got two sort of questions to come in the short time we've got left. One is focusing on the character of the KGB FSB, and then the last one is going to ask a little bit about the differences between the kind of external spy work that we're aware of, or which a lot of publications focus on, and the stuff that actually would have gone on in, say, Eastern Europe, or the destruction or crushing of, say, nationalists in Ukraine, the sort of internal so-called espionage, and whether that's got different techniques and is interesting. But let's focus on the character of the FSB KGB to start with. And you've made various some comparisons to Putin's regime to the kind of mafia. How far can we look at the KGB as at an extreme retributional cult similar to the mafia?
To the KGB or to the FSB?
KGB slash FSB. I mean, there may be differences in your view between them, but.
A cult. Well, I would point your viewers, listeners, in the direction of a very valuable. I found it valuable writing the book, Atlantic Council report, into the nature of the FSB and its money laundering operations. So, and again, the work of Catherine Belton here is superb in terms of revealing the character of the KGB, the men of force, as you said, fused with corruption. To answer your question, is it a what? How do you describe it, Jonathan? A retribution?
Extreme retributional cult. I mean, it seems to have this omerta quality that if you are disloyal, I mean, being corrupt is not necessarily the path to being punished, but disloyalty is the ultimate sort of sin.
That's absolutely right. There's loyalty to the regime and now today to Putin. The thing about corruption is that the when and I had the privilege of interviewing a FSB defector to the US who's been resettled to the US and was trained in the FSB in the 1990s. But he pointed out that when everyone is corrupt, it's not just one or two people that's corrupt. When everyone is corrupt, when everyone's on the take in a service, it allows a leader to then fell any enemy by just pointing out that corruption. And it's actually, this is the thing that is not being reported, and it seems to me discussed enough within China. It's the same strategy that the Chinese Communist Party has with systemic corruption that allows Xi Jinping to again fell enemies and factions competing against him on the charges of corruption. So his massive anti-corruption charges, sure, the people that he's targeting are corrupt, but everyone's corrupt. So it's the perfect way to get rid of your enemies. So I hope that does some justice to your question.
It absolutely does, and I mean that thought occurred in the 90s that in a lawless society, you can pick and choose who you punish within that kind of regime. I think that maybe is the ultimate lesson Putin learned from the 90s was not to create a framework or system of law. It gives him a lot of power. The last question I think is an interesting one because. I've been sent some interesting books by Ukrainian academics in particular about the sort of what would have been the sort of KGB struggle or its equivalent in the post-war era, suppressing the quite extensive nationalist sort of insurgency to an extent in the Baltics, or that's a little more peaceful there, but on the territory of Ukraine. Now, these people might be labeled as this, that, and the other now, but I think it's a fascinating to look at the fact that this was going on right into the 50s, but also, of course, you would have had all sorts of techniques developed by the intelligence services to crush dissent in Ukraine, Eastern Europe, and right across the territories. Are we talking here about the sort of bulk of, if you could call it sort of, active espionage? Would far more of that have been taking place than the sort of foreign services? And would they deployed different techniques than the ones we would have seen in place against the US and the UK, for instance?
Well, sorry, Jonathan. There's a lot going on in that question. But let's start off with one striking statistic, which was when before the recording started, we mentioned the Matrokhin archive and the KGB secrets that were smuggled out of the Soviet Union, Russia, as it collapsed, portions of which have now been declassified and are available in Cambridge in the UK. But what the Matrokhin archive shows in the book that Matrokhin and Christopher Andrew wrote in the late 1990s, early 2000s, was that there were more Soviet KGB deep cover illegals sent to Eastern Bloc satellite countries than there ever were overseas to foreign territories. So an enormous resources thrown by Moscow, the center, on spying on its fraternal allies, as they called the Eastern Bloc. I would point you and your listeners in the direction of his name is Filip Kosevich, I believe his surname. And anyway, he writes and he tweets under the hashtag Czechist Monitor, and he's doing some extraordinary work on research. On using Eastern Bloc records. You mentioned some of the Baltic countries, but then also Ukrainian records about how the KGB was used to suppress dissent in Eastern Europe. So Czechist Monitor. And then the scholar out at Stanford University, Amir Weiner, he has a book coming out hopefully soon about the KGB internal security role within the Soviet Union throughout its existence. And then finally, another scholar, Alexandra Sukhalov, I think her name is, who has written again about and is doing research into the domestic surveillance of minorities in the 1920s and 30s. But as you point out, it continued on. So, like a good historian, if I don't know the answer to something, I can point you in the direction of people who do know the answer to it.
And that's a great follow-up. But of course, people have to read your book first. We'll put a description of that into the video. But it's been absolutely thrilling talking to you. I know the audience are going to massively appreciate this conversation. Calder, thank you so much for joining the channel today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.